So welcome everybody to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. This is a wonderful turnout.
But before we get started, we do need to remind you of a couple things. Please don't smoke in the warehouse. Also, if you have a cell phone, please turn that off. And please try not to get up during the reading. We will have a 10-minute break between readers.
So up first to introduce Sean Towie is Keith Kopka.
Yeah. I thought I could avoid doing this for a long time, but it didn't happen. Remember, Sean, you asked me to do this. And so when Sean first asked me to introduce him, I honestly thought, man, I really, really, really don't want to write an introduction. But Sean was smart. He asked me to do it after a couple drinks, so my defenses were down. And he also asked me in front of a group of people, so if I refused, I would have looked like an asshole. And I'm sure there's a metaphor in this somewhere for the way in which Sean carefully crafts plot in his writing. The way that he can get characters to do exactly what he needs them to do in believable ways through clear and captivating language. But despite what you might think, this isn't the time or place for metaphors about craft or Sean's obvious talents. See, I had big plans for this introduction. I plan to have Matt and Whitney play Joy Division's Lovell Terrace Apart over the PA speakers while I walked up on stage with a briefcase from which I would have slowly, in front of all of you, removed different articles of clown attire, a red nose, face paint, lipstick, etc., and done a 5-minute crit theory knock-knock joke routine dressed as Scrabble, the world's most serious clown. Unfortunately, a credible clown costume, as it turns out, is very expensive, and as all of us writers know, an idea is nothing without a credible costume. I plan to hold a boombox above my head, a la Say Anything, and share all 4 minutes and 42 seconds of the Cutting Crew's underrated classic, I Just Died in Your Arms Tonight. But I realized that my arms would get tired, and that the gesture would lose impact if I sang along, which, again, as you all know, is impossible not to do with that song. I even planned to deliver the last freestyle from 8 Mile, substituting Sean's name for Papa Doc's name, and Aaron, his wife, for those of you who don't know her, for Clarence. But this became confusing after rediscovering that Papa Doc and Clarence are the same person. And no matter how enthralled I was with the assonance of the line, Aaron's parents had a real nice marriage, it didn't make enough sense to, you know, make me do it. Demoralized but stubborn, I tried to do similar things with lesser hit songs like Who Let the Dogs Out and the Joan Osborne classic What If God Was One of Us. My failures quickly mounting and devolving into gimmick, I found myself slipping Sean's name into Kid Rock's rap metal opus, Ba With The Ba, the effect of which led to such stellar lines as all the crackheads, the critics, the cynics, all Sean's heroes in the methadone clinics. Sean, I have to admit that I didn't read any of the stories that you sent me to help me to prepare to write this introduction. But whether or not I read your stories, I still know that sometimes a shark looks right at you, right into your eyes. And the thing about a shark is he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't even seem to be living till he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then you hear the terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and despite all your pounding and your hollering, those sharks come in and they rip you to pieces. I assume that this is the kind of emotion found in Sean's writing. Like the well-oiled machine of a shark, his prose will literally rip you to pieces. I want to believe that Sean's writing is the kind that you turn to in moments of crisis, on a desert island or lost in the Black Hills near Maryland. And that said, I just want to apologize to your mom, Sean, and to Aaron's mom. I'm sorry to everyone. I was very naive. I'm so sorry for everything that has happened, because in spite of what Sean says, after this, it's my fault, because it was my project, and I insisted. I insisted on everything. I insisted we weren't lost. I insisted we keep going. I insisted we walk south. Everything had to be my way, and this is where we've ended up, and it's all because of me that we're here now, hungry, cold, and hunted. I love you, Sean and Aaron. I am so sorry. I'm scared to close my eyes, and I'm scared to open them. I'm going to die up here. Sean, a day may come when the courage of men fails, when we forsake our friends and break all bonds of fellowship, but it is not that day. An hour of wolves and shattered shields, when the age of men comes crashing down, but it is not this day. Today we fight. Sean Towie has published work or has work forthcoming in the Minnesota Review, Hobart, Word Riot, The Rumpus, and elsewhere. He was a semifinalist for the St. Lawrence Book Award and Black Lawrence Press. He was recently the recipient of the FSU Emerging Writer Award, chosen by Deborah Monroe. He serves as the online editor for Southeast Review. He grew up in Tacoma, and he currently lives in Tallahassee with his wife, Erin. I hear he's a fucking shark.
Thank you, Keith. Cannot wait to repay you for that favor sometime. Thank you all for being here. I'm really excited to be up here. I'm really excited to hear Yolanda later. It's going to be awesome. So I was up here, or I wasn't up here. I was watching Zach Strait up here not too long ago, and he dedicated his reading to his wife. And my wife promptly pointed out that I had never dedicated a reading to her when that happened. So this one's for you, Erin, honey. You got it? Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah. I'm going to read the story. It's a short story. It's called Intervention. It's coming out in the Minnesota Review in the fall. And yeah, here it goes. I was in the backyard packing up the cooler. Chris walked out holding a 12-pack of the South Korean super soda he loved. It came in black and green 16-ounce cans and contained some caffeine compound banned in Europe. He had convinced Tao, the owner of the mini-mart across the street, to stock the stuff for him. "What is that smell?" I asked. "It's my cologne," he said. "The ladies love it." "Go stand by the car. You're giving me a headache." I put the sodas next to the spot I left for Dad's bottle of Smirnoff. The rest of the cooler was full of Gatorades for Chris and me and Diet Coke and Sprite for Dad. I looked over at Chris, and it was one of those times I felt like not going to college and instead sticking around Tacoma long enough to teach him how to not act like a walking punching bag. His acne wasn't getting any better. He had on shorts and tube socks, not in a cool post-punk way, but like an old person. The only thing he ever wore that gave him even an ounce of teenage credibility was the Black Keys t-shirt I bought for him. He was going into his junior year of high school, and he had already aced every math class offered. He registered for classes down the street at the University of Puget Sound for the fall. The kid was hopeless. Dad came out of the house carrying a blue toiletry bag covered in white toothpaste stains that I knew had at least one medicine bottle stuffed with pot. He walked by Chris as he went to the trunk. "Jesus, son, we're going to California, not a strip club," he said. "Is it too much?" asked Chris. "At least we won't lose you in a crowd," he said. Dad reorganized the trunk for a minute, undoing a lot of my work. He always said he was particularly good at spatial dynamics. He walked around the car and kissed Chris on top of the head. He popped the hood, and then he checked the oil. He wiped down the dipstick with an old undershirt. I pulled the keys out of my pocket and jingled them. "I'm doing the driving, Dad," I said. I used the deepest voice I could muster. He glanced over his shoulder at me. "All right, son," he said. His lack of fight boded well for the intervention I was planning. I had already handwritten a letter outlining how his life had become unmanageable since he started drinking again, how Chris and I were tired of him coming home at 1:30 in the morning and waking us up to play Call of Duty, how the only reason he didn't get a DUI picking up Chris from his mathletes competition was because he went to high school with the cop, how he had told me a million times that he stopped drinking cold turkey the day I was born, and so now he was jeopardizing our special bond, the heart-to-heart connection that exists between a father and his firstborn son. I could have done the intervention anytime, but I decided it would be best to do it with Delaney, my half-sister, who lived in Crescent City, California, with her mother. It was an 8-hour drive down to Crescent City from Tacoma, about 6 hours on I-5 South, and then another two on 199 West. I got in the driver's seat, and Chris jumped in behind me. Chris was well into his gangster rap phase, and he had his headphones plugged in. He approached rap with the same systematic ferocity he applied to mathematics. He was listening to every album labeled hardcore in chronological order and reading Cornel West's A People's History of Hip Hop. I turned on the car and rolled down the windows. Dad got in the front seat. "You check the mirrors?" he asked. "I know what I'm doing, Dad," I said. He waited until I pulled into the Shell station on South 12th and Proctor before he released the parking brake. He didn't say anything. He smiled and got out of the car and started pumping the gas. Chris and I went into the store to buy supplies, 3 bags of Swedish fish for me and about 3 pounds of beef jerky for Chris. When we came back to the car, Dad was sitting in the driver's seat. I still had the keys in my pocket. I brushed over the panic button with my thumb but didn't press it. "Dad's in the driver's seat," said Chris. "Yeah, I see that. What are you going to do?" I walked over to the window. "I'm not getting in the car," I said. Son, don't be dramatic. You didn't even check the parking brake. An overweight woman with a face that was all bangs and sunglasses stared at us from the next pump. I'll drive, said Chris, all chipper. I could use the practice. I'm getting my license in like 3 months. Dad and I stared at each other for a solid three count. We couldn't come up with anything to say. Chris beamed at us. A puka shell necklace I thought I'd thrown away hung around his neck. Dad slipped over to the front seat and I got in the back. We were passing Olympia when it happened. Chris had a bad habit of turning the wheel to the right when he checked over his left shoulder, like his neck and hands were wired together. We were cruising down the center lane, and sure enough, Chris looked left and the car drifted right. And then I heard a semi-truck's apocalyptic horn. Time stopped. I could see the scratches on the semi's crimson door. Chris yanked the wheel to the left, so we flew into the fast lane. For a second, I stared straight into an oncoming car, and I will never forget the woman's face. She was screaming, her mouth a perfect circle, her eyebrows up near the top of her head. She wore gold bracelets that sparkled in the light. We sailed into the grass valley separating the southbound lanes from the northbound. I thought for sure that we would end up spinning into oncoming traffic, that my family would finally succeed in killing me, but somehow the car slid to a stop. We panted like dogs. It took me a second to realize that I was digging my nails into Dad's shoulder. Is everyone all right? Dad asked. I was breathing too hard to respond, so I nodded. Chris opened the door and puked. Jesus fucking Christ, said Dad. That was a close one. We all got out of the car. A couple of people had pulled over to check on us, and Dad waved them off. Miraculously, nothing was wrong with our white Toyota Camry. Dad opened the trunk and searched through his bags. I heard the metallic snap of his lighter. I went over to him. He was smoking out of a metal one-hitter that looked like a pipe for leprechauns. I think you should do the rest of the driving, I said. Yeah, me too, said Dad. Let's get out of here before the cops show up. The next morning, we met Delaney and her mother, Stephanie, at a park by the water. Dad picked Delaney up off the ground and rubbed her face with his beard. She squealed and tugged on his chin hairs. Dad put Delaney down, and she ran to Chris and me. I grabbed her by the arms, and then Chris took her legs, and we made like we were going to toss her into the ocean. On three, I said. Don't let go, she yelled. Please. Stephanie watched us as she handed over Delaney's luggage. It's important she eats the food on the day it's labeled, she said. We're trying a new system. Got it, said Dad. How are you two boys doing, she asked. We both said the usual, didn't give any details. It's not that we didn't like Stephanie. It was just that she didn't belong to us. Delaney was the product of a one-night stand, according to my father, so Stephanie was part of the package, like the way our Xbox came with one game we loved and another we forgot existed. Right, said Dad. Well, we better be going. And then I saw tears in Stephanie's eyes, like every summer, like it was anything more than a weekend. She hugged Delaney like she was losing her forever. Meyer's flat was exactly 3 hours south on the 101. It looked like the founders had originally planned on building a gold rush-themed town, but gave up about a quarter way through. There was a wood-paneled general store, a mountain saloon that was really a liquor store, and a laundromat that was just itself. We rarely saw other families at the campsite, and when we did, they usually stayed one night. It was one of the perks. Our tent was blue and yellow, and it smelled like standing water and plastic. There was a hole in the corner that Dad had patched with duct tape. Once camp was set up, Chris and I took Delaney down the hill to the Eel River. It wasn't all that big, especially in the summer, and we crossed a field of sun-bleached rocks to get to the water. Delaney's skin was whiter than the sunscreen we lathered all over her arms and face. She wore a little hat and a swimsuit and sandals. Chris had on these green aqua socks and a plain white t-shirt. That kid. Because I'm normal, I went shirtless and wore board shorts I bought from Old Navy. Delaney stopped and inspected every other rock, picking them up, weighing them in her hands before discarding them. I tried to show her how to skip stones, but she liked the ones that were the size of her palm and made a decent splash. Maybe we shouldn't go too far out into the water, she said. What's the matter? Asked Chris. I don't want to go too far, she said. It's dangerous. That didn't sound anything close to the Delaney I knew. In the past, she would grab onto one of us and go right in, kicking and splashing. She was 6 years old, and she should have been getting braver. Did your mom say that? I asked. Before she could answer, Chris jumped into the water and pretended that something was dragging him down, and Delaney cracked up. I took in the blue river underneath a canopy of deep reds and greens. Northern California is something else in terms of outright beauty, like the moment of creation's warm afterglow. I planned on starting the intervention when Dad was about one or two drinks in, feeling loose but not out of control. When it approached 5 o'clock, I waited for him to make a run to the trunk with his solo cup and take a walk with his toiletry bag. But he kept sitting in his favorite fold-out chair, the one he brought to my soccer games, reading a well-worn copy of the Holcroft Covenant. I circled him like a buzzard. Why do you keep staring at me? He asked. I'm not, I said. You look like you've lost weight. Really? He grabbed the fat gathering around his waist and smiled. Maybe I have. He started a fire, and Chris, Delaney, and I kicked around a soccer ball. For dinner, Dad made BLTs. We sat down at the picnic table where Chris and I had carved our initials 2 years before. Dad served everything up on paper plates. It wasn't exactly roughing it. I went to the cooler for a Gatorade and a super soda for Chris. "Do you want anything, Dad?" I asked. "Just some Sprite," he said. "Sprite with nothing in it?" "Just Sprite." I did as I was told and filled a solo cup with nothing but Sprite. Dad searched in Delaney's stuff until he found a Ziploc bag labeled Dinner Number One to be consumed on first night. There were these little sausage patties and apple slices. She opened a single serving package of cottage cheese and dug into it like it was ice cream. My heart broke. To go with our BLTs, Dad had bought a bag of sour cream and onion Lay's. "Do you want some chips, Delaney?" asked Dad. She kept her eyes on her plate. I could see what she faced each day at school during lunchtime. "I can't," she said. "I'm allergic." Which was bullshit. She couldn't have any because Stephanie saw carcinogens the way people with OCD saw germs. The years before, Delaney ate some of our food, and Dad said we wouldn't tell her mother. We were losing her. "How about a couple?" he said. She shook her head and sort of curled into herself, like she wanted to disappear. Dad dropped it. I decided to hold off on the intervention. I wasn't scared. It was just the timing felt off. In the morning, Dad brushed Delaney's hair. She was old enough to not need the help, but she knew that Dad liked to do it. When I was her age, I could have come home carrying my own severed arm, stump squirting blood, and Dad would have told me to walk it off. If Delaney so much as thought about skinning her knee, the world came to a screeching, coddling stop. I called him on it once, jokingly. "Girls are different," he said. "A scar on a man's face is sexy. A scar on a woman's face is the reason she's married to a neo-Nazi from Kentucky." Where he got that shit from was anyone's idea. Chris and I went for a hike, and Dad and Delaney stayed at the camp. It was an easy, looping 5-mile trail through the redwoods and the hills above the Eel River. Chris had apparently brushed up on his nature knowledge because he kept naming different plants and animals as we went along, kestrel this and western bluebird that. I wanted to hit him in the head with a stick. "Dad didn't drink last night," I said. "He didn't smoke either," added Chris. We kept walking. I told him to cut it out with the Richard Attenborough Planet Earth shit. "Why not, do you think?" I asked. Chris unscrewed his Nalgene water bottle and took a sip. He had filled it up from the river and then dropped in an iodine pill for no other reason than to be extremely annoying. We had plenty of bottled water. "He stopped before," he said. "Maybe he's going to stop again." "He's not going to stop," I said. "Not without our help." "How do you know?" "He keeps a bottle of Smirnoff underneath the front seat. He just doesn't want to drink around Delaney." Chris walked at a faster pace, his black Reeboks kicking up dust. "Listen, man, we need to deal with this," I said. "I'm going to college in the fall. I'm not going to be around to take care of everything." "Danny, you're moving to Seattle. It's a 40-minute drive. It's not like you're going to Northwestern." That last comment was a low blow. Northwestern was my dream school, and I didn't even make the wait list. Chris could be so frustrating sometimes. He didn't get it. The point was that I was embarking on my own path, a path that didn't include watching over my drunk father and wounded gazelle little brother. I deserved the space to become my own person. We stopped by a viewpoint. "I'm staging an intervention tonight," I said. "We're all going to talk about how Dad's drinking has negatively affected us. You can talk about how scared you were when Dad got pulled over." Chris picked up a handful of pebbles. He tossed them into the valley below. I watched an eagle dive bomb the river and come up empty-handed. "I guess you should do whatever you need to do," he said. "It's not about me," I said. "It's about the family." He stood up and wiped off his pants. I took his silence for assent. For lunch, Dad made ham and cheese sandwiches. God knows what Delaney was eating. It came in Tupperware and smelled like something left on the bus. Dad went to take a shower, and I opened a package of peanut butter M&Ms and placed a blue one on Delaney's plate. "I can't have that, Danny," she said. "Who's gonna know?" I put 3 M&Ms in my mouth and sucked. I closed my eyes in sweet, sugar-filled ecstasy. I pursed my lips and moaned. "It's not good for me," said Delaney. "It's not good for my body." "Would I give you something bad to eat?" I asked. "Leave it alone, Danny," said Chris. Delaney nibbled on a banana. I ate another M&M with the same physical delight. "It's really amazing how they melt in your mouth," I said. Chris reached over and picked up the M&M on Delaney's plate. Then he threw it into the woods. Delaney smiled at him, and I stopped myself from punching his arm off. Around 3, the hottest part of the day, Chris, Delaney, and I went back to the river. She held Chris's hand on the way down. I figured she was still mad about the M&Ms, but someone had to tell her that Stephanie was a crazy person, and if that someone was me, so be it. With Dad being the way he was, I was the man of the house, basically, and had to make the tough decisions. When we got to the river, Delaney turned to me with her arms out. "Will you put me on your shoulders?" she asked. And of course I said yes. Her eyebrows were so blonde, they were almost invisible. "I don't want to go too far to the middle," she said. I took a couple of giant lunges into the water, and I felt her legs tighten around my neck and her hands pull on my hair. "Danny, don't," she yelled. "I'm joking," I said. When we returned, Dad still wasn't drinking. I prayed, for his sake, that he didn't try to use his recent burst of sobriety as a defense. I built a fire, only I did it teepee style. Dad said it wouldn't catch, but I was warming up my hands in no time. And then I set up four chairs around the fire pit, all the same distance apart. I tended to the ground, kicking away rocks and twigs. We gorged at dinner. We ate Clif Bars. We ate three ham and cheese sandwiches each. We ate a plate of bacon cooked over the fire. Delaney's third package included dessert, gummy bears that looked more like vitamins than candy. She handed me two, and I ate them both. I made like they were delicious. And then I took a seat around the fire and asked them to join me. "What's the occasion?" said Dad. Delaney scooted her chair over by Chris. It ruined the compass thing I was going for, but I didn't say anything. "Dad, you know that we all love you," I said, "but things can't go on this way." Dad smiled and tilted his head, like I'd made a joke he suspected came at his expense. Chris stared at the ground. Delaney fidgeted in her chair. I removed the letter from my pocket, unfolding and smoothing it out on my lap. I cleared my throat. "I already know what you're going to say," said Dad. "I've read your little letter." "I knew this was a dumb idea," said Chris. My hands began to shake, and I could hear the paper rattle. I had to stay calm. Dad would laugh at me if I didn't, like he was some perfect example of reason and composure. "Son, don't look so shocked. You left it right in the top of your bag the other night. I'm sorry you feel the way you do. Really, I am. But it's fairly obvious that I can stop drinking whenever I want." I rolled my eyes so hard they almost popped out of my head. "Just because you've stopped for a day or two doesn't mean you don't have a problem," I said. "I stopped drinking for 17 years so I could raise you two boys," said Dad. "And I did a pretty damn good job, I might say." His delusion was terrifying in its grandeur. I got myself into the University of Washington. All he did was proofread my essay. I looked over at Chris, begging him to say something. He was hunched over in his chair, drawing in the dirt with his finger. "Good talk," said Dad. "Anyone up for a game of Uno?" I balled up my letter and threw it in the fire. I stormed off to the river, and no one followed me. I skipped stones until my arm hurt, until I was sure everyone was asleep, until I couldn't see the light from the fire anymore. That was when I came up with the perfect comeback. "Delaney," I said to the night. "What about Delaney?" She wanted to go down to the river one last time before we left. The sky was the type of overcast that normally burned off by noon. Delaney pretended that she was a mermaid. We went farther than we had before, passing a curve in the river, and that was when Chris spotted a rope swing hanging over the water. "Are you going to do it?" I asked Chris. "It looks pretty fun," he said. "Do it," said Delaney. "But what if I land on a log?" he asked. "Do you see any logs?" I said. "I'll do it with you." "Nah, Danny, I'm all right." He didn't get it. He needed to toughen up, and it started with the rope swing. I grabbed him by the legs and threw him over my shoulder. At first, he didn't even struggle. He went dead fish on me, just gave up like little brothers always do. Once he figured out what was happening, he punched me in the back and kicked. I body slammed him into the water as hard as I could. He went into the river with a wet smack that sounded like pure, unadulterated aggression. He popped up and stared at me. I could tell he was making fists under the water. He turned around and went back to Delaney. I watched them hold hands and return to camp. I stood there in the eel for I don't know how long, the water washing over my legs. I dived in and let myself get carried downstream. I was fully prepared to offer a mild self-defense and half-assed apology when I got back, but no one said anything. Dad had taken apart the tent, and I helped him roll out the air and stuff it back in the bag. It fit worse each time. Delaney was counting the rocks she had collected. "Daddy, can I bring all of them to Mommy?" he asked. "I think the rocks should stay by the river," he said. "Maybe just one?" she asked. "Maybe just one," said Dad. Chris picked up all of the garbage and threw it in a dumpster. Then he sulked in the back seat with his headphones covering his ears, hip-hop book on his lap. Dad and I finished packing up the car, and then we checked over the camp again to make sure we hadn't left anything. I saw the keys on the table, and I picked them up. Dad stared at me for a second before shrugging his shoulders. "Better than Chris driving," he said. Chris and Delaney fell asleep soon after we merged onto the highway. Her cheeks always turned this adorable red when she slept. And that was when Dad reached into the console and removed two airplane bottles of Jack Daniels. He took a few gulps out of his can of Diet Coke and then poured in the bourbon. I kept my eyes on the road, didn't even acknowledge it. I thought about Lewis and Clark, wondered if they got scared the forest would never end. Dad poured in another shot of Jack Daniels, slammed back the drink, and passed out. We rose over a ridge in Crescent City, that run-down fishing town appeared below. I missed the exit for Rodeo Drive, the one for Delaney's house, because I was a little distracted. I missed the exit after that because everyone looked so peaceful sleeping in the car. And then I missed the last exit because I was taking Delaney back to Tacoma. Crescent City looked a lot better in my rearview mirror. I hoped they would sleep for a couple of hours, and by that time we would be well on our way up I-5, and it would be such a hassle to turn around, we'd probably keep going. Dad wanted Delaney with us. Chris and I wanted Delaney with us. The only person not on the right wavelength was Stephanie, and she should have never moved Delaney to shitty Crescent City in the first place. I heard Chris move. I watched him through the mirror as he looked around. "Where are we?" he asked. "Almost there," I said. Forest-covered mountains surrounded us. And then a sign for Grant's Pass was by. "Grant's Pass," he said. "You idiot, you drove through Crescent." He shut his mouth. "You should go back to sleep," I said. I stayed a safe distance from the car in front of me. I checked my mirrors. Left, right, rear. Left, right, rear. Chris went to shake Dad. I tried to reach over and grab his hand, but it was too late. Dad woke up with a start. He figured it out right away. "Son, pull over," he said. I didn't move. "Daniel, listen to me. You need to pull the car over." He put his hand on my shoulder and squeezed. "Don't touch me." "I understand what you're doing. I do. But she'll call the cops." "Maybe she'll understand," I said. Dad didn't have to say anything because we all knew the answer to that. Maybe we'd win the lottery. Maybe our backyard would turn out to be sitting on a natural gas reserve. I could feel my heartbeat in my ears. "There's a viewpoint coming up," he said. "We can turn around there." What was Dad going to do if I didn't pull over? Grab the wheel? We'd go right over the cliff. I could keep driving until we ran out of gas. We had a half tank left. I went right past the viewpoint, and Dad didn't do a damn thing. He sat straight as an arrow. I was in control. I heard Delaney yawn, and I looked at her in the mirror. "I can't wait to show Mommy my rock," she said. And then she added, "Danny, why are you crying?" A couple of minutes later, I pulled into the parking lot of an abandoned gas station. I got out of the car and walked to the railing above a cliff. The view was to the west, and there were ridges after ridges of sun-kissed redwoods, all leading to a blue speck of Pacific Ocean. Everything was too much, and it would go on forever. Thank you.
And now we have to introduce our next speaker, Jeff Hipsher. Please welcome him to the stage.
Hello, Warehouse. Hello. I'm just going to jump right in. During the 5 years in which Dr. Yolanda Franklin pursued her PhD, she was the only African-American woman poet in FSU's graduate creative writing program. This includes faculty, as out of the 14 fiction and poetry instructors, no woman of color currently teaches in graduate creative writing at Florida State University. This means at no point in her 5 years here did Dr. Franklin share a creative writing poetry workshop with another black woman as either fellow student poet or professor. As part of the assistantship that all graduate students accept, Dr. Franklin taught undergraduate English courses, the student body of which is 64% white. In 2015, 32,000 undergraduate black males applied to FSU, 17,000 were accepted, only 6,000 actually enrolled. Thus, black males make up just 3% of the undergraduate student body. Similarly, black women constitute just 5%. And it's in this aggressively white environment Dr. Franklin was expected to teach and be creative, to politely give notes and receive criticism from her white peers. And she did so while regularly bringing in poems that directly challenged or sought to outright dismantle the systems of privilege they participated in and benefited from. And so Dr. Franklin's poems regularly juxtapose the apolitical white bubble of the workshop with depictions of black life in Tallahassee. Not in an effort to distinguish between the worlds she's forced to navigate, one as white creative space and the other as black womanhood, but rather to show that institutional whiteness makes an active effort to divide. To quote Claudia Rankine, "This investment in whiteness does take work and collusion among faculty and students. The insistence that white supremacy doesn't continue to be our dominant frame takes work. The belief that white lives are not political lives with political privilege and protections takes work. The failure to push back against systems that subjugate others takes work. The constant unwillingness or inability to retain diverse faculty takes work. Dr. Franklin's professionalism, pedagogy, and poetry are a lesson in resistance. One I was fortunate enough through our deep friendship to be taught. Her valued perspective and radical love were great movers in my life, upending my approaches to writing, teaching, and simply existing in the political context of my identity. The time and labor Dr. Franklin invested in my private and writing life was foundational to the experience of earning my MFA. It was a richly profound process I can confidently say would not have happened was I not afforded the opportunity to work with and study under a woman poet of color. Dr. Franklin's influence helped me to question my canon of poets, push myself formally across the page, and to write directly and with purpose about whiteness. Unfortunately, that experience of studying closely with someone whose political reality is uniquely different from my own is one FSU and most other creative writing programs across the country inadequately facilitate through their admissions and hiring processes, thus promoting a sameness in politics, scholarship, and aesthetics that Dr. Franklin's poetry expertly challenges and instructs others, like myself, to resist. And that poetry has won Dr. Franklin a McKnight Dissertation Fellowship, a Kingsbury Award, and the Patricia Dobler Poetry Award. She is a Cave Canem and Kalalu Fellow whose poems have appeared in or are forthcoming from the African American Review, Sugar House Review, Crab Orchard Review, and Southern Humanities Review. Her debut collection, Blood Vinyls, will be published spring of 2018 by Anhinga Press. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Yolanda Franklin to the warehouse.
These things are timed, so I cannot cry now. I will cry later. Thank you, Jeff and the warehouse and all the love in the room, students and friends and mentors and family. Sampling, an ode to female MCs or In Miracle of the Black Female Poet, after Phyllis Wheatley, Lucille Clifton, and June Jordan. Won't you please come and celebrate with me what she shapes into a kind of life without a model, both non-white and woman, a sable Venus whose voyage blesses boats that brought her here. And thank whatever gods may be for her unconquerable soul. Oh, come and do marvel at how could she sing and know of a lyrical life. How did she know and see to be except herself? Come celebrate with me that I am. Perhaps you will, because each day something has tried to kill me and failed. I'm going to read some poems kind of dedicated in the theme of what Hipster said about life here in Florida as an original Tallahassee girl. But I'm also going to read some poems that kind of give you some insight about who I am and where I'm from. Southern Girl Hymn. I come from below the bedazzled belt of the Mason-Dixon line, from a place where the Florida boot can be seen as Jim Crow's stiletto. I come from women who rule blues men that carry guitar picks as pacifiers and rub out cigarette butts like blunts of sage with the same circuitous notion that a wedding ring does not make them monuments or placeholders. On pot shelves, I come from women with swollen hands who create to spite a Parkinson's tremor and rogue memory the sugar girdle hips and red velvet laughter, luring insulin the way Cat 4 hurricanes, sepia Gulf Coast skylines, snap its shawl to whip pecan trees and rustle ratchet wind chimes on wooden front porches. Where I come from, my South sounds like pejorative stereotypes, like the clanging of my mother's aluminum cake pans, like Trayvon Martin's thank you, ma'am, drawl at checkout, and Paula Deen's brazed remark to Hollis Johnson, an employee she asked her on stage, noting that he's as black as the chalkboard behind her. I come from magnolias and dogwoods, strawberries and wild onions, stalks of cornfields and wild acre peas, muscadine trees and cotton emancipations of reneged 40-acre deeds. A place under a horizon of fickle rainstorms where snow only pleads for raincoats, Grandma Lacey's crocheted hats, and a red-thumbed mitten. I come from secrets too big to be heard, a noise so loud angels would swoop and dive from heaven, where you gotta be able to either sing the battle hymn of the Republic or Dixie. Y'all are so sweet. Bop, farm, students in the room. 40 acres and a mule on Apalachicola National Forest. He left, deep-rooted pecan trees, arms full of hanging moss, backdrop the eavesdrop of soughing trees near cornfields, where sweet potato and tomato gardens border remnants of a rusted fence. The color of dried blood once used to pin a wayward bull my daddy and his brother taunted on walks home, past the cottonmouth basking on Grandma Lacey's cement doorstep. You had better hush, hush, hush. Somebody's calling my name. I always jumped a road over snakes with the front wheel of my Huffy bike. Daddy pulped bullet grapes or muscadines for moonshine in the mudroom shot off from the garage. Taught me how to wade out of quicksand, catch catfish with bare hands while squatting in shallow pools of fresh water, and how to track deer, bear, wild boar, and the Thanksgiving turkey, and how to pick blackberries and plant a strawberry garden atop the hill where a 7-foot rattler interrupted five brothers with shotguns. Hush, 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 somebody's calling my name. Could thunder have caused the earthquake Grandma Lacey said loosed floorboards and rattled her photo with the picture frame lamp of President Kennedy? The same summer, I willed folded washcloths to levitate over the laundry basket, like butterflies caught in a mason jar. The ghost of my great-great-grandfather, John Wyatt Hill, called my name nightly in psalm. You better hush, hush, hush. Somebody's calling my name. I'm going to throw in a couple new poems, if you bear with me, in between some old goodies. A love bazaar. A broken left-handed golden shovel guzzle. After Sonia Sanchez. Since this trouble man's slow dig in my sugar ditch, I concocted a roux. I made a seafood gumbo from scratch for him with a hex concocted roux. I gather up an absolute tolerance of onion, garlic, thyme, and each sound. I add filet, paprika, butter, and flour to clot the roux you left behind. Tomatoes simmer into a vermilion stew. I steep and stretch them. A nylon sachet chock full of Crayole metacarpal runes on our bed. Cast all my grandma's double L's, Stella and Isabella each night, and some hairs he left in the tub and spit sigils to seal the roost. I breathe you with a little salt and a lime I later bury bloom down and become high in the soil I transport from St. Helene. You'd grow if you only knew that I walk with ghosts. Oh, if he only knew I fed him what I could not, would not swallow, that the savory gush in his rue was his own jism. 'Cause he's a two-time and no-diamond trouble man who don't want the stuff found in his wildest dreams, 'cause he ain't playing by the rules. The next poem is a mommy poem, so all family members, you'll be all right. And I'm really interested in vinyl, clearly. It's in my title. I'm a manuscript. And I'm really interested in what vinyl does and how it works and how it operates when it's being played, right? So this poem tries to address that interest. Truth be told. One, mother, I'm waiting for you to die so I can tell the story about how on the night my husband tried to kill me. I called to tell you this would happen. My husband, the gun, the rape, the gun, the dream I had the night before under the ceiling fan, a metronome of doom like the single sound of a turnstile playing What's Love Got to Do with It on repeat, I repeat, help me make it through the night. And you ignored my premonition while we were held hostage in that house on a four-way stop. Two. All I could remember were the Sundays you and Daddy played Tina like the secular prey, let's stay together. But my husband, and your grandkids, and I drove by that house today on the corner of that four-way stop. On the corner of that four-way stop, I left that corner of the four-way stop. And now I know you had to know how it takes a fool to learn how love don't love. Now I am a deck full of queens, centuries who steel claw. Better be good to me. And I know you still believe that I deserve this soundtrack I live. But didn't I make you the most beautiful consequences of love? This next poem is titled White Room Syndrome, and it is a poem that I wrote after the reading that the poet, I don't really like to use that word, that the person, Kenneth Goldsmith, a reading he had in May 2015 at Brown University where he read the autopsy of Michael Brown. Preamble. White room syndrome is the white piece of paper facing the author, or a clear and common sign of the failure of the author's imagination. One, habeas corpus. Is an autopsy report a eulogy? Especially when the autopsy of a black body is read aloud for unpoetic effect. To white academics attending a poetry reading on an Ivy League campus, and the genitalia of a black body is still the last line. When a white male poet performs as medical examiner and slave owner at an auction block, does the audience become the body. 2, forensic report. An autopsy report is almost never read as a eulogy. It is always the salt that wakes the dead in hopes of scaring away the funeral. I clenched my Uncle Sonny's hand because my body hung over the edge of a cliff during my cousin Sean's wake. A trail of salt ruined my makeup. I tried not to get snot on his hand. I can still hear my aunt's wake from the loss of her only son while dressing his only daughter for his viewing. When the audience members are interviewed, do they have stories that they need interpreters for? Or maybe the seats are just rows and rows and empty rows of coffins. 3, eating the other. Does the eulogy become ekphrastic or something like a resurrection? Perhaps we should imagine the catalog of the Library of Congress's transcripts of the live tweets. I can hear Julius Fusik's entry of the gladiators over another impossible culpability. Call it conceptual, uncreative writing, poetry, work, art, avant-garde, neo-racism, or necromancy. They will take the body again and again and again. My uncle and godfather is in the audience, so I'm going to read this poem about his brother who happened to be my daddy. On the outskirts of my father, I see a God-made anomaly. Through lakes large enough to receive with ease the gush of Coltrane's A Love Supreme, this is a fact. My great-grandmothers always live past 93, and all their husbands give birth to more sons than daughters. All of us at one time or another have been told to shut up. Don't talk too loud, too slow, or for too long in Tallahassee, in the Carolinas, in the Gullah Sea Isles, in Wakulla, out Route 16, in St. Peter's Primitive Baptist Church. My father tells me in his music group days, during the high reign of Berry Gordy and soul rock and roll, that men like him were recruited whenever they roll into Tallahassee, a small old town full of abandoned fields. These men then were to commence impromptu jam sessions and were paid the perks of it's a man's, man's, man's world. In spite of this, my father still toted me along with all of his equipment, knowing girls always are only meant to be seen, elegant and graceful in manner, appearance, and shape, and would surely be scolded if heard recalibrating the language of my father's digest, the way he chords a story out, which is an acoustic digest, the way he reads and speaks and loves his daughter. It's an idyllic language, which had a chorale of ardent words, which do not mean having a quietly appealing or polite quality free from vulgarity or rudeness. Though there's a word for this in the South, genteel. A word for those small provinces of silence, or for the kind of love that will trouble that silence into music, or another word for poetry. My work defines defining, defies defining, any kin of that very word that's been stretched taut over my body which is a woman's body, my grandmother's, Stella and Isabella's body, and a man's body, my father's blues, now posts under a tombstone like the last trail marker of the Chitlin Circuit, my mother's body, ancestor, a language that can only be made by the brassy jangles of tambourines. I've learned this. My father's aunt married my mother's uncle, and some of us have been demure fabulous. Stella, for example, and she redacted her first marriage to Gentress Jay Jackson, taught me how to clean so I'd know who to fire. And my mother Dolly changed her name from Daisy, just like her mother Stella did from Kalalea, and taught me how to bury secrets like her favorite cake recipes in the bottom of the silverware drawer. And Isabella Bolden bartered a wealthy white surname from Lewis State Bank, the only bank in the South to survive the Great Depression. Grandma Lacey, my father's mother, outlived three sons and two husbands, still lives in the house with a lamp-lit photo of JFK and a working well. These are not lies. This is the truth. My family comes from a long line of women whose heartbeats sound like a needle run out of vinyl. This is for my friend Coco, because it's her favorite poem, and it's her birthday. And I did say that with an F. It's her birthday. Stiletto wedged. A. Legendary headlights prowled, his white baton deflated, sticky from one chocolate martini to buttery nipples and a salty senorita. B. A pair of olives arrested him. I was an extra in the Miranda Act. C. I fucked him. Slowly seated his lap in the back seat in the parking lot in front of the nightclub. He and the cop both came. Since we're talking about sex, baby, just move right on in, and then we'll end with something serious, okay? New poem, so hopefully y'all like it. My Controversy, 1986, for Prince Roger Nelson. Epigraph. Here we are in this big old empty room, staring each other down. First time I fell, I was 13, and it was at the first sight of a shirtless man, the color of raw and unrefined, Shea in a licorice Speedo, handcuffed to his crotch. I do not want to say this controversy was caused by a Prince poster fixated to the closet door of my cousin Army Greg's record room, or that a waist chain lassoed his body beyond the verge of being obscene. All of him an offering, each of his hands raised to each side of his temples, elbows, symbols for greater than all, within this tesserae tile shower, frame and that in the background, a crucifix levitate to. I do not want to say that in this room full of crated albums, this man's hazel eyes and Trojan, my blood began to spin like a needle on vinyl until my kingdom come. Okay, last poem for tonight. And I'm supposed to say that this poem, I have some broadsides of this poem. If you don't know what a broadside is, it's like a poster. And it has a poem on it that you can get from me later tonight. Manual for Still Hunting, White-Tailed Deer in a Gated Community, found poem for Trayvon Martin. Deer hunting in Florida is as old as recorded history. Actions delineated here are designed to ensure public desires for recreation. As deer populations grow, so does popularity of hunting for recreation. The exploitation of deer increases during this period. Still hunting is characterized by stalking or concealing oneself and waiting for quarry. The practice of hunting at feeding stations was legalized, enhancing opportunities for still hunters to locate and harvest. In vehicles, while coordinating movements with cell phones, hunters hunt larger blocks, sit next to trees, or hide in bushes. The newly formed Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission recognizes the need for public hunting lands so Florida's acres are open to public hunting. The vast majority open to deer hunting. To provide landowners with tools and flexibility to control deer numbers, the commission implemented a deer depredation program. Overpopulation is the most pressing challenge. Deer in Florida are considerably smaller. In Florida, whitetails are known to have various types of trauma and are a species of wildlife whose overabundance degrades its own habitat as well as the habitats of others. Delaying harvest of bucks until maturity carries rewards, more bucks in subsequent years. And seeing bucks is a key component of hunter satisfaction. Seminole County is infested with white-tailed deer, so legislation approved deer eradication throughout South Florida. Managing hunter satisfaction enhances overall recreational experiences. The commission began the comprehensive surveillance program to occur at two levels, passive and active. Passive involves observation and culling of free-ranging deer that demonstrate abnormal behavior, suspect or target animals. Active includes random investigating of hunter-harvested deer. The challenge will be to provide an array of opportunities that deer harvest will continue as a necessary and desirable practice for many years. Whether a hunter prefers to harvest only mature bucks or chooses to harvest any deer within range is a value judgment. It is considered the most popular game in Florida. Thank you.